From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 362 of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and we're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. I encourage you to call in early. Any questions, comments you may have, I'd love to hear from you and actually spend the time reviewing as much as possible and answering your questions as thoroughly as possible over the next hour. I wanted to bring some good news first. This has to do with hepatitis. On Wednesday, Rob Snow and I talked about hepatitis A and B. There was an article in on CTV News talking about the extent, almost 2 billion people with hepatitis, different forms of hepatitis worldwide, and that there are means of preventing the disease for hepatitis A and B. There are vaccinations that give you terrific protection from contracting those liver diseases. The other hepatitis virus, for which there is no vaccine, hepatitis C, up until now, there's a means of trying to treat it. And for some people, you can cure it with the treatment. For others, you can't. The standard of treatment right now was considered to be interferon and ribavirin, about 40 to 50% effective. And duration of therapy for this particular treatment is 6 to 12 months. So although it can cure hepatitis C, only 40 to 50% of people respond. Well, after 20 years of research, the Food and Drug Administration in the United States has approved two new antiviral medications. They're called protease inhibitors to treat hepatitis C. One is called Victrelis, and the other is called Incivec, and they were approved 1 week apart. The latter, Incivec, I-N-C-I-V-E-K, is what's considered to be the more potent of the two, and they may become, the speculation is that they may become the new first-line treatments that affects, in the United States, using U.S. data, about 4.5 million people with hepatitis C and 200 million people worldwide. So, you know, you divide by 10, roughly, for Canada, so you're dealing with 450,000 people with hepatitis C in Canada. And what they found when they looked for the approval, they obviously want to see what the efficacy is, how well it works, what are the side effects, how long does someone have to take the medication for, what are the long-term effects. And so in a pilot study that they used to determine optimal doses of using Incivec and interferon combined, 93% of the patients in the highest group had their viral levels drop below the limit of detection within 12 weeks. So no virus detected after 12 weeks, and by 24 weeks, all signs of the virus were gone in every patient. So within 12 weeks, it cured their hepatitis C in all the patients that were involved in this study. Now, we would want to know exactly how long these patients had hepatitis C, what age they were, did they have any other associated medical conditions. So you want to try and compare apples to apples, but nevertheless, this is remarkable efficacy for a medication, considering that the previous medication, the one that is used now, is only half as effective. Now, the caveat to all this, although you have to keep in mind that for people who get hepatitis C, these people can go on to develop cirrhosis, liver cancer, end-stage liver diseases. So, I mean, this is something that goes on throughout a person's life, and the cost, not only the economic cost, but the social impact and the lifestyle impact that it has is tremendous. So over the course of someone's life, you're looking at likely hundreds of thousands of dollars of care that's required. And the reason I bring this up is because the cost of treating a 12-week course of treatment for this medication in the United States is close to $50,000. So extremely expensive. But I would argue that if this indeed becomes the standard of care, that this should be covered by our provincial plans and by insurance companies, because the overall cost is a cost savings for in all aspects of the person's life, both financially, socially, and also from a workplace perspective. People can continue working and have completely normal lives. That in itself is, I believe, justification for having a medication this expensive. Again, it was 10 to 20 years of research to be able to produce these particular medications, that this will go a long way to alleviating a lot of the burden for a lot of people in Canada and the United States and around the world. So I'm pretty pleased about this particular approval. It gives people who have hepatitis C a lot of hope, those that are undergoing treatment right now that may not be responding as well as they would have liked or their physicians would have liked. It's certainly an avenue to explore. I'm certainly not saying go out and get this medication. I'm simply bringing to light that there is now an approval, official approval of these medications, and that it is now up to the liver specialists to determine, in conjunction with discussing with their patients, the usefulness of this medication for their particular condition. I don't know if it's been approved in Canada yet. It is a U.S. approval, but I'm certainly hopeful that if it has not been approved, that it soon will be, as we tend to follow what the United States does with regards to the approval process. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is the long distance number to call. Looking forward to your calls. We have Sue in Ottawa who would like to discuss hearing problems. The rest of our lines are available. And I also want to get into a study that's been published recently on BPA, conducted by the Environmental Protection Agency, Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration, about the safety of BPA, just as a comparison to what we discussed earlier with Mark Sutcliffe on Friday, radioactive cigarettes. I'll be back in just a sec.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And going straight back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Sue in Ottawa. Sue, are you there? Sue? I guess Sue is not there. We'll put her on hold, and we'll go over to line 3. And Sandy, good afternoon. Sandy, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a problem. I recently had a bout of high blood pressure, and I went to the Heart Institute, and I asked the doctor there, mm-hmm. why is it when I stand too long, I get nauseous, I get a pain in my stomach, and then when I see the stars, if I don't sit down, I'm going to pass out.
Right.
And it's just been getting worse over the years. And I was just wondering if there's any long-term problems with that, not having enough blood going to my brain.
What you're describing is what we call postural hypotension, meaning that when you stand up, mm-hmm. there's a drop in blood pressure. Normally,
yeah.
what the body will do, it sometimes can be delayed for some people,
yes.
especially if they're on medications to control blood pressure. Mm-hmm. What happens is that because of that delay, you get less blood flow to the brain, mm-hmm. and that's why you start seeing stars and feel nauseated or that you're about to faint.
Mm-hmm.
There's no inherent danger of that specific reflex that happens. But the danger is if it progresses farther than that. That is, you actually do faint and you fall. Obviously not something you want to have
happen.
Well,
when I get to that point where I see stars, I just sit down.
Right.
Wherever I am, I have to sit down or
right.
I'm going to fall down.
And how long does it take for this to resolve itself?
It depends how long I've been standing up.
Mm-hmm.
But when I sit down, I start to feel better.
Right.
And I don't know, I just sit down for quite a while before I get up again.
Okay. And is this happening every day?
Yes. Yes, and it happened when I was uptown to see the Royals. Mm-hmm. I was standing there.
Right.
And I literally had to sit down because I was going to pass out.
Right, and it was I think it was relatively hot that day as well.
Yeah, yeah. But it doesn't matter. Right. I've done it in mass. Mm-hmm. I do it everywhere.
Okay.
Standing in the grocery line, whatever.
And there are medications that you're taking for blood pressure?
I was, but he said my blood pressure has gone down, so I don't have to take it. But when I stand up, they did say my blood pressure goes down when I stand up.
It does drop a bit. So are there any other medications that you're taking?
No, the only thing I'm taking is estrogen. That's all I take.
Okay. Are you getting any exercise? Are you doing anything?
Yes, I ride my bike.
Perfect.
And I do other exercises at home. I always have.
Okay. Well, The difficulty you face now, Sandy, is that there's no medication that's going to reverse that process. You don't want to give you something that actually increases your blood pressure.
No,
there's no medication.
No.
So that's the issue. The only thing that can be advisable to people who have postural hypotension is the first is when, and you probably know this already, when transferring from a lying position to sitting or to standing, to do that very slowly. And not to get up, you know, we tend to get out of bed, we just tend to bound out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, because we're warm in bed and you get up, your blood vessels on the surface of your skin are dilated. And so you stand up and all of a sudden your pressure will drop. So it's usually advisable to sit on the side of the bed for about a minute and then to gradually stand up, not to just stand up within a few seconds, but to stand up very slowly. Because what you're trying to prevent, because ultimately what is happening is that your nervous system, which we call the autonomic nervous system, meaning it works automatically to try and control these things, is delayed. It has almost like a 5 or 10 second delay, so that when you do change your body position, what tends to happen is that the blood pressure drops, but your body, instead of responding quickly with your heart rate going up and your arteries constricting, takes some time. And so you get that nausea feeling and that seeing stars type of effect. Mm-hmm. So although that's helpful for when you want to transfer from sitting to standing, it doesn't really help you if you're already standing.
No, when I'm standing in a grocery line or wherever, it'll start.
Now, one of the things that can sometimes alleviate that, and although it may look strange to others, is to actually, there are a few ways. One is you're trying to get your heart rate up to prevent this from happening.
Mm-hmm.
So it can mean either shifting on your feet or even jogging on a spot for
a few
seconds.
I know,
and that will help.
I know. I try to go back and forth on my feet.
And it will help because mm-hmm. what you're trying to do is assist your body to maintain blood pressure. And whenever you exercise, which is why I asked about exercising, whenever you exercise, it's very unlikely that you're going to get faint.
No, I don't.
Yeah, because your blood is circulating much faster. Your heart is working faster. Blood pressure goes up a bit when you exercise. It's avoiding situations where you have to stand in line, not moving.
Yeah.
So if you are in line, it's now a matter of even pacing back and forth or just moving around. Standing still, your body goes, you're standing still, it starts to relax, blood pressure can drop. For the same reason that the guards on the hill sometimes
mm-hmm.
will collapse or fall over because they're standing so erect and not moving, it's exactly the same problem that they have. They haven't been able to move. Blood is pooling down in their legs. They're not walking. There's no circulation going. And they just drop flat onto the ground.
And so, sometimes when I'm standing, I get little dizzy spells. Like they just come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's the same thing or it's something else.
If it's something that's coming and going within seconds, then it likely is similar.
Yeah.
It's more if the dizziness or the lightheadedness persists for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 minutes straight, that's not normal. And the reason it isn't is because, again, that autonomic nervous system should work relatively quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And so something that goes 40 minutes long means it's not that problem anymore. It means something else is contributing to the dizziness.
And does that mean I'm getting less oxygen to my brain? Like in?
Well, you're temporarily, because you have less blood flow, there's less oxygen delivery. But it's not a stroke, and it's not damaging the brain.
But I wouldn't end up with Alzheimer's or something.
No, this has nothing to do with Alzheimer's at all. In fact, your exercise that you're doing with your bike is one of the things that can help contribute to reducing the risk of Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
So the lack of blood flow to the brain on a, you know, for 10, 20 seconds where the body recovers is not going to cause any brain damage. What causes brain damage is when there's a complete obstruction of blood flow. So a blood clot that goes to the brain that causes a stroke, or of blood vessel ruptures in the brain that causes what we call a hemorrhagic stroke. But otherwise, what you're experiencing is we call mild hypoxia, meaning that there's a hypo means less, oxia refers to oxygen level. So you're having less oxygen being delivered to the brain, but not in any sufficient amount or duration that would cause any brain damage.
So it wouldn't be helpful to stand on my head or anything like that.
No.
I used to do that.
I wouldn't do that. And the reason is because the minute you try to turn yourself back upright, your blood pressure is going to drop again. And you don't want to stand on your head too long because, again, the blood vessels in your head were never designed to experience all that extra blood pressure. Because if you're on your head, it means the whole column of body weight and blood is now rushing towards the head. Not a very good thing to do.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Sandy.
I'm trying to do all those things.
Yeah, and it will look strange to others when you're standing in line, but you do have to move around. You do have to do those things because that's the way you'll prevent it. You're just using your body's own physiology in a very natural way to try and prevent that from happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Okay. Bye-bye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility. 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. And we're going to go to line one. And Gary in Ottawa, good afternoon. Gary, are you there?
Yes, Gary's here.
How are you?
I'm fine. And you, doctor?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
I have arthritis on both knees.
Yes.
But I go for physiotherapy, and it's under control, no pain.
Okay.
In that case, you think that I should seriously think about going for knee surgery?
If you're not having any pain, then there's no reason to get knee surgery. The only reason for having knee surgery is if your function, that is your inability, you have less and less of an ability to participate in the activities that give you pleasure in your life, that allow you to maintain your independence and activities of daily living. But if you are able to do all of those things, doing the surgery is not going to present you with any more advantage. It's not going to make you less painful. It's not going to increase your mobility. So really, whenever you consider surgery, you have to always compare the benefits of the surgery versus the risks. And if you're saying to us that your knees are not painful, and that you can walk and do the things that you need to do, then there's no need to do the surgery because the risk is operating on knees that really are not painful,
right,
turning them into knees that will be painful, turning them into knees that will have rehabilitation to do, that you run the risk of blood clots after the surgery. All those are small risks,
right,
but you're already starting from a standpoint where you're relatively fully functional.
Right.
As opposed to if your knees were extremely painful, you've tried all sorts of modalities to try to reduce the pain. Your knees get stiff, they lock, you can't walk properly, you're becoming deconditioned because you can't do the exercise you want. That then outweighs any of the risks of the surgery because the outcome of the surgery for most people is a dramatic improvement in function.
Right.
So that's how we look at whether surgery is required or not, in part.
Also, doctor, I have a hyperthyroidism,
mm-hmm,
and I am taking Tapazole, 7.5 mg.
Okay.
Looks like I'm losing weight all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I have a problem with varicose veins, about 4 or 5 inches higher than knee, mm-hmm, on both legs. And the doctor has sent me for ultrasound and Doppler test, which I'm going in September.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's the right thing to do. He wants to look at what the blood flow is like in the veins. With regards to the hyperthyroidism and the Tapazole, usually you have to have this monitored, and I'm sure your physician is doing that, to monitor the thyroid level, because weight loss can happen if your thyroid hormone level is a bit high. And there may be other things that contribute to that, but that would have to be with regards to speaking with your physician, Gary. But we have to go for a break, and I thank you very much for your call.
Thank you, doctor. Okay. You have a good day.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye now. And we are going to take a small break and get back to your calls. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bow Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 are the numbers to call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in about 3 minutes right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And we're heading back to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Bill in Prescott.
Good afternoon, Doctor.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, coming along. I have a problem with my fingers and thumb.
Mm-hmm.
They're numb. Been this for over about a year. I had attended a chiropractor,
yep,
physiotherapist, and a massage, and nothing seemed to help. And I have a heart pacer, mm-hmm, which is already installed about 9 years ago.
Okay.
And I believe that the only way they can find out where the pain, whether it's carpal or whether it's the ulnar, mm-hmm, or a nerve coming down from the back of the neck, or is with a TENS test. And I was wondering, is there any way with a heart pacer to overcome this or to promote to perform this type of a test? My fingers are numb. When I squeeze them towards my hand, you know, mm-hmm, it seems a little different.
Okay.
And but they all move back and forward. I've been doing some exercises with placing thumb fingers over the thumb and pushing them back, and things that the therapist had told me to do. And so I was just wondering if there's any way of overcoming this heart pacer situation. Somebody told me there may be a way if you apply the TENS test in a certain manner,
mm-hmm,
that might be able to trace where the pain may be starting. I don't know if you know anything about this.
Yeah, my understanding of an electromyogram, which is the test that will look at the conduction, it's called a nerve conduction study.
Yes.
To look and see if which nerves are compressed or potentially blocked.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the voltage and the current that is required to do this is very low. And it's unlikely to cause your heart to enter into an arrhythmia or to affect the pacemaker, which is shielded. So it's unlikely to really cause, as far as my understanding is of this, it is unlikely that that test is contraindicated for what you have.
I see.
Now, the question I have for you, though, with regards to the tingling in your hand, is it all the fingers or are they...
All the fingers and thumb.
So even your pinky finger?
Yes.
Okay, because that would exclude just carpal tunnel syndrome if that was the case.
Yes.
Because if it's the entire hand, including the pinky, that means that it's the ulnar nerve and the median nerve that are affected. Because the median nerve, which runs through the center of the wrist on the palm side of your hand, supplies sensation to your thumb, your ring finger, your middle finger, and half of the your index finger, your middle finger, and half of the ring finger, the fourth finger, whereas the ulnar nerve does the other half of the ring finger and your pinky.
That would apply to both hands.
Yeah, and so if this is in both your hands, you may have nerve damage in both of those nerves.
Well, I had a dislocated shoulder on one side,
mm-hmm,
and so that it's the tingling isn't as strong as it is,
mm-hmm,
on the other hand, on the left hand.
And usually, if it's both hands that are doing this, where you have, although as you mentioned, it's varying in intensity. If it's both hands, it's much less likely that you have something at the level of the neck that's doing this to you. And the reason is that usually if there's a disc rupture, the disc will either deviate to the left or the right. It's very rare to see a disc just on the basis of how the anatomy is in the neck for a disc to be able to compress both nerves at the same time.
I see.
So it's less likely to be the neck, and usually there's also associated pain in the neck area.
I don't
area.
Have any pains, though.
Right. So that means it's something local that's going on at the hands. Have you in your course of work, do you tend to use your hands a lot?
I'm retired.
Okay, but prior to that, has there been anything where you've used your hands a lot, or how
just as a normal thing, gardening or cutting grass or snow.
Okay, so the bottom line is the EMG is still something that's recommended. Usually the person that's going to do the EMG, you know, you would tell them that you have a pacemaker, but I don't see how that would cause any damage. When you think about it too, I mean, there are people who have pacemakers that go in CT scans, which also is a highly energetic field to be in.
Yeah, you have to stay away from anything that's magnetic.
Yeah.
Even your car. You can't stand close to your car
right.
when you have
right.
it.
Right. But with regards to an EMG, there's no magnet that's being used. So it's just a tiny current that runs through, and very unlikely that it's going to disrupt a pacemaker.
Well, I spoke to the doctor, and he was worried about, might it stop the pacemaker?
I don't think that's what's going to happen. It's just those pacemakers are designed to withstand a lot. They are shielded.
Yeah, it's about 9 years old.
Yeah, and again, the current that's going to be running is going to be running down the arm. The current is not going to be running throughout your body. So it's not. It's unlikely that any of that current's directed towards the heart.
I see.
So, again, I'm certainly not, it's not a procedure that I do. There are specific physicians who do this test, and they would certainly know better than I would. But just from thinking about this on how they do the test, it doesn't strike me as something that would be contraindicated in your situation.
I see. Now, what happens if this continues? Could you lose the use of your hands completely?
If we're making an assumption that it's both the ulnar and median nerves that are being compressed, the answer is, over time, yes, you can lose the function of your hand.
How long would that take, then?
It usually is on the matter of years when someone is experiencing this and how severely compressed the nerve is. The issue is the loss of function is because the muscles in the thumb, especially, tend
to
shrink.
You lose the bulkiness around the thumb.
That's right, and you can't get that back afterwards. And so that's what you end up with, what's called an ape hand, where the thumb is off to the side instead of in front of the hand, and you can't bring that thumb around anymore.
So what happens then?
Well, that you don't want to get to that point because that's very difficult to reverse. So ultimately, if this is a compression of those nerves, the test itself will show exactly where along the, literally it follows the wire, which is the nerve. Mm-hmm. It'll show exactly
the median nerve.
The median nerve and the ulnar nerve. Will show exactly where the damage is or the compression is, so that the surgeon will know exactly where to go and remove whatever is pushing on that nerve. Usually it's what we call a release, where they just cut through the tissue that's putting pressure.
Yes.
And that alleviates the initial damage. It can still take months and months for the nerves to heal after that. So the tingling doesn't go away right away, but it reverses the process. The nerve is able to regenerate and heal up, and the hand regains its complete function again.
How long would that take, roughly?
Usually, when you have that kind of damage, again, if you've had this for some time, I would usually say anywhere between 3 to 6 months is the usual time for a nerve to repair itself.
I see.
So I would definitely look into having this evaluated. The most common areas for the median nerve to be compressed, again, is in the wrist, and the most common area for the ulnar nerve to be compressed is right around the elbow, right around the funny bone.
I see.
And those are the most common sites where you will see compression of those nerves. And that certainly would be where they'd be aiming for to really analyze whether something's happening.
My doctor said, maybe we should just, on the basis of do an operation on the wrist and see if that clears it up. And if it doesn't, go on the other.
For me, I would like to know exactly where the damage is.
Yes, that's what I thought.
Because you can always do surgery, but what if the surgery doesn't fix it? Then you're stuck. You really want to do the evaluation at least to know where it isn't damaged.
Yes.
And so you can isolate the area. When you don't isolate the area, you're sometimes going in blind, especially it's the ulnar nerve as well. So it's not just the median nerve. It's not just operating on your wrist. If your pinky finger is numb as well, you know, we have to figure out if around the level of your elbow you're getting compression.
Yes. So it's best to find out exactly where it is and where to operate.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's fine. That's what I've been thinking, and the doctor thinks the same way, but he's they were concerned about the heart pacer, and he's written to the device people.
Well, that's
and the other thing, we're hoping to get an answer back.
Yeah,
from them.
The other thing that your physician can do is just simply call up the person who does the test, and because they've seen thousands and thousands of people in all sorts of conditions, and they will be able to answer them in 5 seconds about whether it's okay or not.
Yeah. Well, all right. Thank you very much for the information, Doctor.
You're very welcome, Bill, and I hope things get better for you.
No, I hope so, too.
All right.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And what I think we're going to do is we're going to take a break now, since it's about a minute before the break, and then come back with your questions instead of trying to rush through. We've got Louise in Ottawa, who has some cramps in fingers and toes, Nicole in Ottawa, torn tendons, and Barry in Ottawa would like to discuss vitamin D. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Heading right back to the phone lines, and good afternoon to Louise in Ottawa.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Dr. Dworkin. How are you?
I'm fine. How are
it's
you?
Fine day. I'm good. I'm good.
Good.
Yeah. I was just wondering, I get cramps in my fingers and my toes, and I'm wondering, is there something lacking in my system, or like, why does it do that? It drives me nuts.
When does this happen?
Anytime. Anytime. My fingers, it can happen when I'm doing something small, like sewing or, you know, closing a pin or something, but it can happen just anytime as well.
Does it happen at night as well when you're sleeping?
Yes.
It does?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you get the cramping not just in the toes, but in the lower legs too?
Actually, it's just starting to do that.
Okay. Yeah. Are there any medications that you're taking?
No.
So no meds? No. Okay. It's cramping. The most common cause of muscle cramps in an otherwise healthy person is muscle fatigue. That is, so when you're doing fine work, for example, if you're doing the sewing, the needlework, or where you're holding your muscles tight and you have to, the muscles can fatigue and they will cramp up. Just like anybody that does any type of exercise, if they push too much, they can get cramps. Dehydration can cause cramps. So so not drinking enough water during the day if you're thirsty.
I drink a lot of water, but
well, that's good. What we call something called electrolyte imbalances, that is when someone doesn't have the right sodium levels in their body, but that's rare to see again in someone who is healthy. At night people can get things such as can get cramps at night, restless leg syndrome and other cramps that can happen again. The what we call the etiology or the reason why it happens is not entirely clear. I guess my question would be for you, when this first started, when did you start to experience this?
It's been a while. I mean, I don't know, like 4 years ago or.
Okay. And how long does the cramp last?
Well, if it happens in my toes, I have to get up out of bed and I have to walk around.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then
it'll go away.
Okay.
And my fingers, like if it happens on one hand, I have to take my other hand and separate the fingers.
Right. So, yeah. it must be painful when that happens too.
Well, it's not fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a few things that you can do as well just to make sure we're not missing the boat on anything. So, You know, there are blood tests that can look at sodium levels.
Sodium level.
Yeah, calcium level is not really that helpful because your bones will keep your calcium level relatively normal. Thyroid function, sometimes thyroid difficulty can cause cramps. You know, I'm trying to stretch it a bit. I'm not sure what else to do for you.
But I'm writing all this down.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
You know, I'd have to try to, I can't think of, again, 4 years, it really hasn't changed too much other than the cramps continuing. You know, I certainly wouldn't want to recommend medications right yet until we actually know what's going on. But there are things that can help with cramping, especially at night, that will alleviate cramping. It always boils down to the frequency that it happens, the ways to alleviate it. Sometimes, again, it depends on the activity that we do. If we're sticking with one particular activity for too long, you can sometimes end up, again, fatiguing the muscles that control the fingers and toes.
Yeah. And I understand that. Yeah. I understand that, but it just happens out of the blue.
Yeah.
You know, like what the heck was that all about?
Yeah. So I would, and the other thing too is to look for any potential nerve problems in the arms or legs that could sometimes stimulate the muscle to cramp.
Yeah, I have that. My two pinkies are numb.
They are.
Yeah.
Are they numb all the time?
Yep.
Well, that tells us something. That tells us that. Now, do you tend to lean on your elbows when you're sitting or doing things?
Oh, well, I'm on the computer a lot.
Yeah, so your elbows are sitting on the side rests a lot?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're likely compressing your ulnar nerve, which is, as we spoke with our last caller,
yes, the ulnar nerve is right
where your funny bone is on the inside of your elbow, and people tend to rest their elbows on things, and that compresses the nerve, and that can give you the tingling in your fingers. Whether that's causing the cramps,
Well, that's totally separate.
That's totally separate, but that's why you're getting that numbness in your both your pinky fingers. So ideally, you want to put a pad or something very soft on those armrests so that your elbow is not being compressed, that there's not a lot of weight being pushed on that nerve, or sitting in a different position so that your elbows are not pushed against anything.
Okay. So if I start doing that, like I've been trying hard to do that. But if I start doing that, like really being,
very vigilant about it.
Yeah, vigilant about it. Is it going to go away or?
It should. I mean, ideally, if the underlying cause is compression in that area, alleviating the compression should help alleviate the tingling. But that can still take months. And ideally, what you may want to do as well is to have the elbows looked at, again, with a nerve conduction study to see the extent of the compression that's there. Because sometimes surgery is done to alleviate the compression if there's a lot of scarring or damage that won't reverse itself just by taking your elbows off the
But anyway, so like
chairists.
The pinkies don't bother me. It's the cramping that.
Yeah, I would at least start with those blood tests. The other thing too is I still would do a nerve conduction study of the hands and the legs. Okay. Check blood sugar as well if you haven't had blood sugar done. Cholesterol levels, just again to make sure that.
Oh, cholesterol.
Well, again, if there's a risk of cardiovascular disease, you want to make sure that you don't have reduced circulation to the feet, which can certainly cause cramping as well, and can also cause lack of blood flow to the nerves, which can also lead to cramping. So there's a whole host of things that I think would be helpful. It doesn't mean that you have this, but it's certainly something to do to rule out any possibilities.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay. Well,
all right,
thank you,
Louise,
very much.
You're very welcome.
And have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye
now. Good afternoon to Nicole in Ottawa. Nicole, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin.
Afternoon.
I would like to know what's your opinion about having surgery for a torn tendon.
Which tendon?
Oh, I don't know.
I
know in the shoulder.
Oh, it's in the shoulder. So it's likely a rotator cuff tear or something.
Yeah, it's extremely, extremely painful. Mm-hmm. I already called you about that. I've been going round and round and round since February.
Right.
And
usually repairing tendons is the thought is that to repair a tendon, you'd have to ask what is the consequence of the surgery? Is it going to improve somebody's function? How long has the tendon been torn? Because if the tendon's been torn for an extended time, the muscle itself is all contracted, and it's very difficult to stretch that muscle out to join the tendon up again and repair it.
What's long time?
Long time is 3 to 6 months usually.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's been since February,
yeah,
and the muscle now is likely quite contracted, I would say that surgeons would be very reticent to want to repair that tendon because the consequences of the surgery may be worse than the condition that you're starting with. Because you can't bring the two pieces together. They're too far apart now.
So how do we fix that?
You can't.
I have to live with the pain, you mean?
The pain would have to be controlled, but it's very difficult to repair the torn tendon in the shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that, I mean, I would really discuss that with, if you have managed to see an orthopedic surgeon, to discuss that with them about what the options are. But ultimately, it may mean controlling the pain. And also, there are specific therapies to build up the other muscles around the shoulder to compensate for that.
I see, because it's going to take, as you know, 8 months to 14 months to see the shoulder specialist.
I hear you. And Nicole, it's something that even this week in my office, we've had the same kind of difficulties getting access to specialists that
mm-hmm.
for patients that need to be seen right away.
Yeah.
It's an extremely frustrating endeavor for everybody, and I have no solution for that, unfortunately.
Would the MRI show anything? I had an MRI last Monday.
Yes, an MRI will show if the tendon is torn, how bad the tear is, where the muscle is. So that is very helpful, and yes. that may help also determine what course of treatment will be offered.
Okay, Dr. Dworkin.
All the best to you, Nicole.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. And we're going to go very quickly. We only have about a minute left. Barry in Ottawa, good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon, doctor.
Hi.
Hi. Be very quick.
Okay.
My doctor, GP, sent me to endocrinologist.
Yep.
Vitamin D. And he put me on 2,000 units a day.
Okay.
Now, there's a doctor, American doctor, on the CFRA radio program, suggest that minimum 5,000 units a day.
2,000 is plenty, Barry. There's no reason to go up to 5,000, although there's limited evidence that going from 2,000 to 5,000 is going to do very much.
Okay.
It's not going to be necessarily dangerous for you, but again, my patients, I usually have them go to 1,000, 2,000 on the available evidence. Again, more doesn't necessarily mean better.
Okay, Health Canada suggests how many a day?
Well, the Canadian Cancer Society is recommending 1,000 and even more for others with other, for
right.
pregnancy and stuff. Health Canada is still behind. They're still saying 400 to 800. But 1,000, again, not going to do harm. 2,000, definitely not going to do any harm to you.
Thanks very much, doctor.
You're welcome. Bye-bye now. And that about wraps up the show. My thanks, everyone, for your calls. Always stimulating. And we will be back next week with another edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.